Last night, out of curiosity, I was checking the dates for next year's Feast of Tabernacles, and even a bit beyond. I took it right up to the year I turn 100, you know, just in case. Okay, maybe not. But on the Roman calendar, day one of the feast in 2024 will be October the 17th, which is a Thursday, which means, of course, that at most sites, opening night will be Wednesday, October the 16th. There are a couple of sites that don't have meetings on opening night, Branson for one, Hawaii for another, for various reasons, and they have two services on the holy day. That's a little bit late on the Roman calendar, later than this year by 10 dates, since this current Hebrew calendar year we're in has an extra month, which pushes all the festivals a bit later. It goes later by roughly 10 to 12 days, or the other way, it gets earlier sometimes if we don't have. But at any rate, for the next 2 years after that, actually about 18 to 20 days later, but at any rate, the next 2 years after that, it creeps a bit earlier each year. So those of you who are looking for a time to visit a northern site, you might want to wait a year or two just in case. My wife and I recall 1 year when we were in Regina, Saskatchewan, and I was the feast coordinator. We had 12 inches of snow during the feast, which was a little bit unusual. The city wasn't quite ready for it. The plows weren't broken out yet. It was very interesting, to say the least. But our attendance did not drop. Those were pretty hardy people, and they made it no matter what. Dog sleds were lined up outside the hall. No. For the next 2 years, it gets earlier, and the first day of the feast in 2025 will be Tuesday, October 7th, and the Sabbath of September the 26th in 2026. As of right now, just in case you were wondering, the next full moon will be next Sabbath, October 28th, technically at about 3:24 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Of course, we'll fall back to Eastern Standard Time about a week after that on Sunday, November the 5th. Now, counting that full moon next week as the first, on the 13th full moon, because of that extra month, the feast will begin again. Aren't you excited? Now, does that sound just a little bit silly to look that far ahead? Next year will be my 64th Feast of Tabernacles. And I did write them down because I was worried I would forget. I have a list at home of where I was every year. For a time, it was just me and my family, and there's a remarkable year beginning in 1973 where somebody else was with me ever since. 1 year, we attended two sites in 2003 when we went to both New Zealand and Australia. But it's something to look back on and think about and remember feasts, because we begin to base our year around that cycle of God's holy days. You may be talking to friends or neighbors, and they'll say, well, I think it was right after Christmas in something or other, or it was right before Easter in such and such a time. But we don't calculate that way. We talk in terms of the holy days. Thinking of it as kind of silly depends really on how we tend to process information, and maybe just a little bit on how locked in we are to God's patterns, His special times, and His entire plan. Do we think about it because it defines our purpose in life and who we are? Sometimes, we've occasionally, even now, have new people coming to the church. But when you stop and think about all they have to learn, it's a bit of a daunting task. Those who grew up in the church or were in it from a young age have a distinct advantage, because the case with you is that you got used to thinking about it in those terms from a very young, malleable age, as long as you were clued in. Does your life revolve around all of that? Some come along much later in life. I've recounted the case, I mentioned it at one of the sermons in the feast in Hawaii this year, of a sweet little old lady I baptized. I think the oldest one I ever baptized was in Ottawa, Ontario, our last Canadian assignment. She was 83 years old when I baptized her. She had just lost her husband of 60 years at that point. And we talked and counseled a lot of sessions, long and hard. She had a lot of questions. Finally, basically, her last key question she was trying to process, she said, "Why would God call me now?" She was understanding things quite well. "Why would God call me now?" And I said, "Well, Mrs. Calloway," she's long gone, so I can use her name, "I don't know. But one day we'll find out." She had 3 years. And during those 3 years, she was a remarkable addition to the congregation. Everybody loved Emma Calloway. She was just a lively sort and just thoroughly enjoyed being part of the church for those 3 years. Do we still think about the lessons we learned at and from the feast just ended? It was just 2 weeks ago today, the eighth day, or the last great day. Now, depending on where you were, let's see, for us, it would have been at this point in time where we were not quite 5 o'clock in the morning. 6 hours time difference in Hawaii, yeah, 5 hours behind here. But I guess behind, ahead, depends on how we got there first in this time zone, but they weren't there yet, so however you'd want to count it. It took us about a week to get adjusted, so just about the time we had to turn around and come home, we were settled right in. I think we're back to the normal now. What if this is normal? But then there's that contrast all around us. Isn't it kind of a jarring shock when you come back from the feast? We've found it that way. Now, if some are unable to go, it's not quite the same because you're still immersed in the world. You're not, even if you can listen to messages every day. In our neighborhood this year, apparently the Halloween decoration of choice is a giant skeleton standing maybe 12 feet high. I don't know exactly because I haven't gotten close enough to measure it because I don't trust myself to not, oops, and accidentally trip and stumble. And I tripped. I'm sorry. I fell. I knocked it over. Sorry. As I snapped the bones. Never mind. One yard, even now, or now at this point, has smaller skeletons that are being hung from the arms of the larger, even more grotesque one. It's awful. I was about 8.5 years old when my parents first began to attend the church, so I have some very vague memories of keeping Halloween. But you know, back then, it was usually a Disney character or a cowboy, complete with cowboy hat, you know, and chuck wagon for my, you know, a little bag of goodies. It just seemed so much more innocent back in those days before the cars had been invented. It's not that far back. But it's awful. Halloween is the pagan holiday that I hate the most. Now, I know God says, "I hate your solemn feasts," in some of his inspired word, because they aren't being kept in the right way. My wife and I certainly agree on that. In fact, I have to restrain her when we take our neighborhood walks. Because it's not a matter of me tripping and falling into it. She'd hit it with a flying tackle. So I have to keep an eye on her. "Oh, look at those fall colors, honey." Anyway, the contrast between what we just kept and what the world is now embracing could hardly be more profound. And thinking of what we just kept brought back, at least for me, as I was preparing the sermon, some very positive memories. Because at the feast where we were this year on the Kohala Coast, the western side of the Big Island, as they call it, of Hawaii, which they spell with an apostrophe between the two I's over there, we saw many faces, which, to use the idiomatic English expression, were just like that full moon that initiated the feast that night. They glowed. They glowed. They shivered in the hall because it was kind of chilly in there too, but they glowed. It's only been 14 days since it all ended. That's hard to process. Did you come home from God's marvelous feast like those glowing feast goers we saw where we were? Were you on a spiritual and emotional high coming back from appearing before Him where He placed His name? And if so, are you still there in your mind? Or is that sensation hard to hang on to? The question is, brethren, for all of us, and I'll ask it, has our glow started to fade? I think if we're honest, we would admit that it's hard to maintain the intensity, even if we still have a firm, locked-in focus on God's way. And there are ways to try to maintain that. Certainly daily contact with God, the new book that you've just been given or will be shortly, Five Tools for Spiritual Growth, will help. One of the ones that's been added that we haven't traditionally talked about on the same level before is fellowship. And of course, that's part of why we're here. But let's think about that a little bit more today. Turn to the 16th Psalm, if you would, please. The 16th Psalm. And I'd like to read the entire verse. Be grateful it's not the 119th. Preserve me, O God, verse 1, for in you I put my trust. Margin says, watch over me, O God, in my edition of the Bible. O my soul, you have said to the Lord, you are my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you. As for the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. Is that who we most enjoy being with? Those with like mind? It isn't that we don't love family and friends. It isn't that we don't appreciate excellent neighbors who can be trusted to look after our property when we're gone. We appreciate them greatly, but we don't have as much in common. It's hard to talk and share things, the things that mean the most to you, with people who don't share that view. Their sorrows shall be multiplied who hasten after another God. Brethren, the people in the world who don't have the knowledge of God don't lack for troubles and problems, as Mr. Scott Lord was talking about last night in Friday Night Live, if you watched it. They just don't have solutions. They still have the same problems and trials and difficulties everybody does, because that's part of being human. But they don't have answers. It's not that coming into God's way removes problems. It supplies answers. There's a difference. There's a difference. Their drink offerings of blood I will not offer, nor take up their names on my lips. O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain or uphold, margin, my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. I'm not quite sure which lines he is managing a reference to. For some reason in my head, I think of fly fishing and lines falling like that, but that's me. That's weird. I caught my first fish when I was 7 years old using my dad's 7-foot fly rod, so I kind of have those memories. Yes, I have a good inheritance. I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart instructs me in the night seasons. I have set the Lord always before me. I'm keeping my eyes on Him. Because He is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Brethren, we have to ask ourselves, when we stumble and slide into some area that we know we shouldn't be doing, who moved? Us? Did we move or did God move? Did he move? I don't think so. Therefore, my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh will rest in hope. Now we're getting into messianic references. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol. That could have applied to David, but next verse, in the next words, nor will you allow your Holy One to see or to undergo corruption. Jesus Christ was in the grave for 3 days and 3 nights, 72 hours. His body did not begin to deteriorate. And then verse 11, you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. There are a lot of interesting verses in there. I think of verse 2 where it says, you're my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you. Paul later on said, in me nothing good dwells. I think that's what he was thinking about. Think about what we're reading. And the clincher for me is verse 11, the last verse, with the obvious note that verse 10 includes a prophecy about Jesus Christ. Where have we just come from not so very long ago? For me, for the 63rd time. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, let's go back there and take a look. Found it interesting, Mr. Angelou's note, and speaking to some of you who were in Branson and saw him and spent time with him. Yes, he says he has from a few weeks to a few months to live. Where was he this year, 2 weeks ago? This is Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. We're familiar with this. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks. You may recall from the details for an agrarian and agricultural society like Israel, there was a different method of determining the tithe with animals. Normally, we take the first tenth off the top for God, and the next set, second, is for the feast. With animals, it was different. Do you know which animal was God's? The tenth one. You think about it. Why? Because what if you only had one animal increase for the whole year, and that was God's? What would you live on? He is an entirely practical and loving God. He says, you got animals? The tenth one I'll take, so that you don't give me more than. You know, you want to make an offering, that's up to you, but what I require is a tenth. Therefore, it'll be the tenth animal. Logical. Logical. Anyway, firstlings, firstborn of your herds and your flocks, you can take care of the feast needs by making sure that's set aside. You may learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the journey is too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you when he's blessed you, then exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses. And you will spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink. Now, always with God's instructions like this, always they fit within the context of his overall instruction. He's not saying you can go out on an all-night bender if you want. That's not the point. Always in moderation of those things. But you're going to be there at a special time and in a special place. And you will eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. There's a lot in this section. Second tithe, yes, that's what it's about. How are we able to enjoy such abundance? If we're obedient and have saved our second tithe faithfully. I've known, of course, of others who just took whatever they needed, bare minimum, and they missed part of the point of the feast. We're able to enjoy that abundance on a physical level at the feast in ways that we probably can't the rest of the year in most cases. And of course, if people are very blessed financially, that may not be the case, but for many of us it is. What's the key? The key is in verses 23 and 24 and 25 and 26. Note the operative phrases, verse 23, before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. Verse 24, the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name. Verse 25, the place which the Lord your God chooses. 26, eat there before the Lord your God. What's the stress? Where God chooses to place his name. Sometimes, for some reason, I've seen cases where that wasn't happening. But it's important that we're there where God's name has been put. So what do we learn? Well, verse 23, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. Cower in fear? No. To have a deep awe and respect for God and for what he instructs us. It's for our own good. Think about Deuteronomy 5:29. You don't need to turn there, but I can read it to you. You might want to keep your hand, your fingers where we are now. But 5:29 says, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever." Why does God want people to keep his law? Because it's designed for our well-being. Why do things seem to fall apart in the world around us when people don't? Mr. Franks made an observation last night in Accord about the attacks by Hamas in Israel. He said it has changed the face of the Middle East forever. Mr. Register, who was the feast coordinator in Hawaii where we were, was very helpful that morning after the news of the attacks came in. He said, "I would like to make something clear." He said, "Let me illustrate with an example from my past." He says, "When I was serving and working in Western Canada years ago," he said, "I would sometimes make references to World War II." This was many years back when he was first in the ministry. He said, "And I would say, well, the Germans did this or that." And then he said, "One lady came up to me one time after the service and said, 'Mr. Register, can I say something?'" He said, "Of course." He said, she said, "I'm German. My family immigrated after World War II to Canada. We were never Nazis. There is a difference." And he said, "Thank you." So Mr. Register said, "Please understand, as you look at what's going on in the Middle East, there are Palestinians who are descended most likely from Ishmael, some of them, some families from Lot. But perhaps you didn't know, do you know what ethnic background 25% of all citizens of the nation of Israel are? They're Palestinian. They are Palestinian Israelis, as we found out on our trip. And they are being used as human shields and as all kinds of despicable things in this attack by the extremist group Hamas." So Mr. Register said, "Please make that distinction in your mind. Don't lump everybody in together." Some of the most affable and warm-hearted people we saw on our trip there were that way. When my wife wandered into the gift shop one day in the hotel where we were staying, you know, she was offered the food and, you know, "Here's the lamb stew, here's pita bread, you know, dip in." As she said, they wouldn't take no for an answer, and neither was I going to. So we mean to be aware of those things. Do we make the connection of all this? Do we make the connection when God says that you may fear me always? What the purpose is? Why is the feast so wonderful? It always goes quickly, always. We had some bantering going on there at the feast in Hawaii where one gentleman was saying, he says, my wife does not want me to talk about what day of the feast it is. She does not want me to say it's day four. Don't tell me what day it is. I don't want to know. Because they march along relentlessly and it progresses from opening night to day one, to day two, to day three. Stop! Stop. The feast, is it wonderful because we have more money than usual? No. No. Deuteronomy 16. Verse 13. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from your threshing floor and your winepress. And you shall rejoice in your feast. You and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow in your gates. 7 days you'll keep a sacred feast to the Lord, your God, in the place which he chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. 3 times a year, the pilgrimage feasts, as the Jews of Christ Day referred to it. Shall all your males appear before the Lord in the place which he chooses, Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, they'll not appear empty-handed. Every man shall give as he's able according to the blessing of the Lord your God which he's given you. What's the focus here? We usually turn there to talk about offerings, as we should. But what's the focus? The focus, brethren, is the blessing of God. The holy day offerings are a chance for us to express it in whatever way makes sense for us financially. Being mindful, for example, of the widow's two mites in the example of the New Testament where Jesus said she gave more than they all. What if somebody throws multiple thousands of dollars in the offering? Well, that's great, but they're perhaps in a position where they can afford to do that. And that's wonderful. I'm glad for them. We should all be. But that's not the focus. The focus is on the blessing. The fact that God blesses his children, which we acknowledge 7 times in a year, and that we rejoice before him because we enjoy his favor. The physical blessings are only part of it. Okay, let's cut to the chase and see what we're talking about today. And you're saying, it's about time. Anyway. We can learn a great deal from a miraculous experience from the life of Moses. Turn back to Exodus 32. You say, wait a minute, I know what Exodus 32 is. That's the golden calf. Yes, it is. It's the golden calf story. Do you know the background? Moses, with Joshua, was up on the mountain receiving instruction from God. At the conclusion of their discussions, 40 days and 40 nights, God gave Moses the 2 tablets or tables of stone engraved with the 10 commandments, etched by his own hand, his own finger. When he and Joshua returned, they found to their horror that the Israelites had persuaded Aaron to put up a golden calf, which was a likeness of one of the chief deities of Egypt. One of the things we noticed in Hawaii was astonishing to us. We sort of knew to expect it. The degree to which the Polynesian culture is just suffused with idol worship. It was all around us. All around us. It's astonishing. You know, the four-armed deity. I'm not sure whether it's Vishnu or Shiva or which one. Or maybe, you know, half and half. I don't know. It's astonishing. But at any rate, here they are. We know what Aaron's excuse was. Basically, he told Moses, you know what the people are like. I told him, just give me all your gold, and I threw it in the fire, and this calf walked out. Well, it's not exactly the way it happened. Human nature. They were busily engaged in worshiping this calf with all of the accompanying ribald and lewd behavior that you can imagine would go with it. Later in the same chapter, Moses dashed the tables of stone or tablets of stone against the ground and smashed them at the foot of the mountain, verse 19. And then he melted down the idol and he ground it into powder and scattered it in their water supply, so that they were literally forced to consume their god. The result in chapter 33 was that God told Moses of his intention to distance himself from them. He would no longer dwell in their midst in the tabernacle. That's in verses 1 to 3, chapter 33 of Exodus. Verse 3, he says, "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey. I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." It's quite something. What happened next? Well, he would send them, but he says to Moses he won't lead them. What must that have been like? Verse 7, Moses took his tent and he pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and he called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp. Now, usually being outside the camp is a curse. In this case, God moved out there, in effect. So it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle, that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. Silence from maybe 3 million people, whoever could see. Moses goes out to the tent. Notice what happened. It came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle, the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Eternal talked with Moses. It was a visual cue that God was talking with Moses, the one who later became Jesus Christ, the Word or the spokesman. All the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and they rose and worshiped, each man in his tent door. They were grateful that at least God was still talking to their leader. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. Moses would then return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Well, young is a relative term. We know that Joshua was more than 20 because he was exempted from the death sentence to those who were over 20 who wandered 40 years. So he was 20 when they left, which means he was 60, you know, when they entered the promised land. So it's a relative term. This was quite something. And all of that emboldened Moses. There's a very serious discussion that happens between the two friends in verse 12. Moses said, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you found grace in my sight. Now I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you and that I might find grace in your sight. Consider that this nation is your people." Oh, by the way, God, these are your people, not mine. Just saying. And he said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then he said, "If your presence doesn't go with us, my presence, don't bring us up from here. How then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? We'll be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth." There's a difference being made here. So God said to Moses, "I will do this thing that you have spoken. You have found grace in my sight. I know you by name." And then Moses said, "Please show me your glory." He said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live." God said, "Here's a place by me. You'll stand on the rock. And so it shall be, while my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand, and you'll see my back, but my face shall not be seen. I'll push you into the cleft of the rock, and I'm going to move past you. And as I'm leaving, I'll pull my hand back, and you'll see me departing. You'll see my back as I walk away." Kind of impressive. Then we find the instructions. Moses is to cut two more tablets of stone, just like the first ones. "Be ready in the morning. Come up on Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain, verse 3 and verse 2. Let no man come up with you. Let no man be seen without all the mountain. Don't let flocks or herds feed. In other words, there's a barrier. Don't let them cross beyond that. So he cut two tablets of stone, just like the first ones. He rose early. He went up, just as God had said, and he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. The plan is to replace them. You see verses 5 to 9. God descended, stood with him, proclaimed the name of the Lord, passed before him and said, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, verse 6, long-suffering, abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generations. Not because he's vengeful, because choices have consequences. And they don't impact just us. So Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. And then he begs again, if I've found grace, please go among us, even though we're stiff-necked. Pardon our iniquity, our sin. Take us as your inheritance. Us, our, we. Moses prays on behalf of the people. And God said, I'll make a covenant. Before all your people, I'll do marvels, etc. He says, I'll consider it an awesome thing that I'll do. I'm driving out before you the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusite. Don't make covenants with the inhabitants of the land. They'll be a snare to you. Destroy their altars, break their pillars, cut down their images. Don't make a covenant with them. Again, he stresses. Or otherwise the people will play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to them and so on. And then he relates almost like part of the Ten Commandments. You'll make no molded gods, Feast of Tabernacles you'll keep, etc., etc. Just relates some of the instructions again. Verse 21, the Sabbath. Three times in the year, the reference to the three gatherings. Cast out the nations again. I'm just sort of skimming through, which you can do too. All these various reminders. So it sums it up toward the end of the chapter, verses 27 and 28. God said to Moses, write these words, for according to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And it was so when Moses came down from Mount Sinai and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand, God had written the commandments on these again, that Moses didn't know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Can you imagine what that was like? I went back to the old Basil Wolverton Bible stories last night. I was working on this, and I found the part in the end of the first volume where it deals with this. And one chapter ends where the people are gathering at the barrier, seeing him coming down, and somebody calls out, look at his face! So Moses called to them, and all the rulers and Aaron came, and Moses talked with them. And afterward, the others, he gave them the commandments. When he had finished speaking, he put a veil on his face. Whenever Moses went in before God to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out. And then he'd come out and speak to the children of Israel whatever had been commanded. When they saw his face, that the skin of his face shone, Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with him. Now, we're not told all the details of what happened. Nothing else is said about this in this strange development later in the account. We have to assume that in time, Moses' face lost its unusual glow and returned to a normal appearance, and the veil was no longer needed. The only other reference to anyone's face shining in the rest of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, is in Numbers chapter 6. So turn to Numbers 6. Numbers chapter 6, verse 24. Speak to Aaron and his sons, God tells Moses, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name, the margin says, on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. It's a figurative reference, isn't it? It's metaphorical. God's face would shine on them. Well, brethren, that's what I'm talking about today. Isn't this where we've just been not so long ago? In God's presence. Isn't this what we want in our lives, to have God's face shine on us? A bit over 3 weeks ago, we left home to attend God's great Feast of Tabernacles. He has figuratively caused His face to shine on us. And when it does, like Moses, we're supposed to glow, at least metaphorically. Remember the passage in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, verses 14, 15, and 16? A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. So let your light shine. It's metaphorical. And while it already seems to be rapidly retreating into the past, I can't quite believe that it was only 5 weeks ago today we were gathered up Cuyahoga Falls, Community Vineyard Church, keeping the Feast of Trumpets, most of us. 5 weeks ago today. Where has the time gone? Just 2 weeks ago, we were in God's presence on the eighth day, or the last great day. Well, we were all in God's presence. Of course, for my wife and myself, it was still only 5:30 in the morning, exactly 2 weeks ago today. 6-hour time difference. It's a sensation like no other in the Church of God, as all who have attended can attest. There is, or there should be, a powerful sense that He is present with us as we obediently come before Him to worship and to learn. Think of a couple of instances of what is clear intervention to protect feastgoers this year. Mr. Franks mentioned them both last night. One involved CAGWA, one involved the United Church of God. The CAGWA members in Guatemala, roadblocks after the election, protesters blocking the main roads of exit between Quetzaltenango, where they had the feast, and Guatemala City, where most of them lived. Some of them made it through, got through as soon as the feast was ending, but others were stuck for a whole week. Thankfully, the facility, you know, tried to help with the cost of housing being relatively cheap. I'm sure the church will help out in whatever way is needed. The 100 that were left behind, that was the smaller part of the group. They had a pretty healthy attendance there at the feast site. Most of them made it out right after the eighth day was over. But they made it through. It took them 24 hours traveling together in convoy to get back home the night of the 14th into the morning, early morning hours of the 15th of October to get home. The other was with, and certainly we knew some people who were there with the gathering, the United Church of God held a feast site in Jerusalem this year. When Hamas attacked on the morning of the eighth day, they were stuck. A handful made it out to Tel Aviv, through Tel Aviv, Ben Gurion Airport that night. Most had to hang back. They eventually all were able to transition through Amman, Jordan, and fly out through Jordan. Sometimes, of course, the flights involved bypassing the area of combat, swinging way out of their way so they wouldn't be shot out of the sky. Some of them ended up transferring back through Rome, some through, I think, Paris, others through Istanbul, Turkey, but they all made it home safely. At the feast, yes, there are many physical blessings. We usually are in beautiful settings, especially true for Janelle and me this year. Couldn't quite believe it. We sent a picture at the sunset the first night we were in. We had a bite late to eat. We'd been up 22 hours. We were a little, you know, still sorting that out. 14-hour travel, but get to the airport early and so on. Get your rental car. It's not satisfactory. We have to get another one. Delay, delay, delay. Finally, we sat down for a late supper, whatever time it was. Our bodies couldn't tell you. And watched the sunset over the Pacific. My wife clicked a picture, sent it, and our son texted back, said, "That's Photoshop. That's not real. Nothing looks like that." Yes, it does. It was beautiful. We're able, when we're at the feast, to enjoy physical blessings on a level that is usually unattainable during the rest of the year. It all drives home a point about God's perfect plan, the physical plenty that the world's humans will experience during the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. But now we're back home. Let me ask a question. Did the old challenges that you had facing you when you left for the feast, did they all magically disappear when you got home? If they did, I would really like to talk to you. How did that happen? I'd like to know. Because the answer is probably not. Most likely they were waiting for you on your return. But that's not really the question to ask ourselves. Did we come home changed in some way? That's the question to ask. Were our faces glowing from being in God's presence, like Moses' face? Or has our glow begun to fade? How close are we to Him? Turn to Revelation chapter 1. Revelation chapter 1. Verse 12. I turned, John said, to see the voice that spoke with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. That's the New King James translation. I think the authorized, the older one says candlesticks. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the feet, girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes like a flame of fire. His feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. He had in his right hand seven stars. Out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was like the sun shining in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. But he laid his right hand on me and said to me, "Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am he who lives and was dead. And behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. And I have the keys of Hades and of death." And he was enjoined to write the things he had seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. That was John's trust. Brethren, those conditions do not change. Jesus Christ still looks like that. He is now the Son of God. He was the Logos or spokesman or the Word, eternally in existence with the Father before there was time. I can't describe it any better than that. That condition does not change. He stands amidst the lampstands with his people, his body, his church, which is a spiritual description, those in whom the Spirit of God dwells. Chapter 21 of Revelation. read the couple of verses toward the end, verse 22, describing the New Jerusalem. I saw no temple in it. Revelation 21, verse 22. For the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. Chapter 22, verse 4. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp, nor light of the sun. For the Lord God gives them light, and they'll reign forever and ever. And you know that's a good thing, because in a few billion years, the sun's going to burn out. Aren't you a little worried? Now, if I could had said only a few million years, you might have relaxed a little bit. So, oh, I thought he said billion, a million, who cares? Now, of course, as beings in the family of God, if it's decided that once the sun burns out, that it should be replaced with something else. Would that is going to be hard if God designates, delegates to you or to me and say, can you make a new sun? I kind of like the one we had. Can you make a new one? Sure, first thing, I'll get right on it. I don't know what the future holds, neither do you. These verses show what will be the norm during the time when all are spirit in the family of God. That's what these chapters talk about. In the kingdom of God. Remember, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom, 1 Corinthians 15:50. For now, 1 John chapter 3 ought to be our watchword and modus operandi. Does this describe you and me? 1 John 3:1. What manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God? Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know Him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as he is pure. What does it say in the end of chapter 20 of Revelation about those that are brought up in the resurrection of judgment, second resurrection, to be judged? It'll be their time. It's our time now. 1 Peter 4:17, judgment is now on the house of God. It says there are three factors. The books of the Bible are open. Clearly a reference to the books of the Bible. The books are opened. They're judged out of those books. What else can it be? The book of life is open. Their names are etched into it. And it says they're judged by their works. Three things. The vast majority, we certainly hope and pray at that time, will choose to follow God. Unfortunately, the next few verses talk about some who won't, and that's what we call the third resurrection. A few verses earlier, it stresses in Revelation 20 that those who are in the first resurrection, it says, over such, the second death has no power. Interesting place to be. Do these verses in 1 John describe us? The feast should function as a powerful boost to help us keep on going forward in God's way of life. Yes, there will be challenges. Yes, there will be tests. Again, Mr. Lord's very excellent Friday Night Live last night. He pointed that out. He says, you know, the topic was, why do young people have trials? He said the answer was basically because they're people. People have trials. It doesn't make any difference what the age is. People have trials. God's way provides some source for answers, is the clue. There are some practical steps we can take to slow the glow fade, if I can put it that way, or slow the fade glow. For example, suggestion. Remember those sermon notes you took so carefully? I'm making an assumption. Have you looked at them since you came home? If not, why not? If not now, when? If not you, who? Don't put the book in the closet and leave it there. Have you talked about the feast with friends and gleaned some of their experiences too? Sure, we all had some. Have you been meditating on some of the lessons that you learned on sort of a maybe a, just an added tweak of understanding that somebody said something a certain way, whether in a sermon or in fellowship or whatever, that new nuggets that you mined while you were there? You know, there are some other examples to consider. Turn to Acts chapter 7. Like the announcement about my friend Bernard Angelou is sad, but his attitude is not. This chapter is sad, but the man's attitude was not. Acts 7 and verse 55, after Stephen has finished speaking, it says in verse 54 that they gnashed at him with their teeth because they were cut to the heart by the things he said. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God. Jesus standing at the right hand of God, like Moses seeing the back. And he said, look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. And they cried out with a loud voice. They stopped their ears and ran on him with one accord. They cast him out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. And they stoned him as he was calling on God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Remarkable account. The first martyr of the New Testament church was Stephen's glow fading. I don't think so. Doesn't sound like it. It wasn't literally glowing, of course, but reflecting the power of God with the calm assurance and peace that God gave him during this trial. Along that line, look at a rather powerful passage a little earlier in the account. They bring all kinds of false accusations and false witnesses. Verse 13 of chapter 6, they set up false witnesses who said, this man doesn't cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. We heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. That is twisted, totally out of shape. Yes, he said, there won't be one stone left on another. Yes, he was taking exception to the teachings of the Pharisees and Sadducees, but it's twisted. And all who sat in the council, the Sanhedrin, however you want to pronounce it, looking steadfastly at him, saw his face as the face of an angel. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but I guarantee you he wasn't distraught. That's what they saw. Think about that for a little bit. What did it mean? I don't really know. Chapter 7 begins with a high priest asking, are these things so? And he begins his defense. He was about to answer the charges. This was not the time to hold back. Somehow God made him aware. This was not the time to be careful with his words in the same way that you might normally. God intended to give him courage to say what had to be said as a witness against the corrupt leadership of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And it would all work into God's plan for all of his disciples back then, that the early church had to spread out so they could fulfill the work that he'd given them to do. They were all tending to gather still in Jerusalem. They weren't going anywhere because they had this impression that Christ would return soon. They were selling their farms. They were selling their properties and giving it to be distributed. Except Ananias and Sapphira, there's a moral lesson in that one in chapter 5. This man, Stephen, was given a special charge to bring it about. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not an assignment I would appreciate drawing that short straw. But we don't have any record that he shrank back. Let me ask you a question. Maybe it's not the way we would have done it, but where will Stephen be 1 million years from now? You have any doubts? I don't know how we'll count millions if we're all spirit beings and there's no light, no dark, nothing but light. I haven't figured that out yet. Get back to me on that. As Mark Twain would have said, I need to go into training on that one. Get back to me and ask me the question later. See the point? He'll be glowing. Who else? 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul toward the end of his life. You know the passage, verses 6, 7, and 8. I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure is at hand. I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, not me only, but all who have loved his appearing or looked forward to it. Where will Paul be 1 million years from now? Second Peter chapter 1. I won't go into the section on the building and adding virtue to virtue to virtue, but I'll pick it up in verse 12, 2 Peter 1. After he talked about that, he said, "For this reason, I will not be negligent to remind you always of these things, though you know and are established in the present truth. I think it is right as long as I am in this tent, as long as I'm still here," Peter said, "to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent. I'm going to die," he said, "just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me. But I'll be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease. We didn't follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received from the Father honor and glory when a voice came to him from the excellent glory saying, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.' We heard this voice, which came from heaven when we were with him on the holy mountain, the transformation. So we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." Morning star in your hearts. Will that cause your face to shine? Will it cause his face to shine on us? Obedience, faith, confidence, closeness to God, there is no substitute. There is no shortcut. Clearly, there is one example that we must never overlook, the one who set the perfect example. Turn to Luke 23. Luke 23, verse 33, I'm cutting into the story flow, which I'm sure you know. Jesus Christ was about to be murdered judicially. It says, "When they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing.' And they divided his garments and cast lots." Now follow up on that premise. Verses 46, 47, 48. "When Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last. When the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, 'Certainly this was a righteous man.' And the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned." The effect on bystanders after he died, and his impact again on mere humans. Look at the next chapter and the disciples on the road to Emmaus. This is one of my favorite stories. Verse 13, two of them were traveling to a village called Emmaus, 7 miles from Jerusalem. About 60 Roman stadia, roughly 7 miles. They talked of all the things which had happened. When they conversed, Jesus drew near them and went with them, but their eyes were restrained, so they didn't know him. And he said, "What kind of conversation is this that you've had with one another as you walk and are sad?" And one of them said, "You must be the only stranger here. You haven't known what's happened?" So they began to relate it all to him. And then in verse 25, "Foolish ones, slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Ought not the Christ to have suffered these things to enter into his glory? Beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them on all the scriptures the things concerning himself." Then they drew near the village, and he indicated that he would have gone further, but they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, it's evening, the day's well spent." He sat at the table with them. He broke bread, blessed it. He took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it. Their eyes were opened, and they knew him. Their eyes flew wide open, and guess what happened? He vanished. How would that have affected you? makes the hair on the back of my neck, what little I have left, stand up. There's more back there, though, by the way. But anyway. So they rose up that very hour. They went back to Jerusalem, and they spilled the beans. They said, you're never going to believe what's happened. And just as they get to the punchline, poof, he's there. Must have had a really fast taxi. Were their faces glowing? I don't know that. But in verse 32, right after he vanished, you know what they said to each other? Didn't our heart burn within us while he talked with us on the road? And when he opened the scriptures so we could understand them. I don't know about the faces glowing, but their hearts were burning. Moses had an incredible relationship with God. He was a friend of God in what appears to be a unique way in the scriptures. He asked God if he could see him so that Moses could be encouraged to continue to lead the children of Israel under God's direction to the borders of the promised land. And for a time, his face glowed with the reflected glory from close contact with the God who made the entire universe. Not long ago, brethren, we were in God's presence too. Now, I don't recall being shoved into a cleft in the rock and having somebody hurry past. But we heard God's words if we asked him to inspire the messages. We saw in action his way of treating others with kindness if we asked him to help us and others at the feast site serve our brothers and sisters and set an example to those around us. We were comforted by the knowledge that no one is left out in his perfect plan if we grasp the meaning and the opportunity of the eighth day, the last great day of his revealed festivals. And then we came home again. Did you crash to earth, perhaps? Has our glow faded? To some degree, that's up to us, isn't it? How much effort will we exert to stay close? Will we cling to him who is our life? What are our priorities? Take one last look today in Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. And I assure you, that glow will never fade.